This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Well, today's a very special day. I have a very special author coming on a little later. She is embargoed. Whoa, what does that mean? That means I can't read her book before I interview her. Nobody can read her book because It's going to be a bestseller, and they don't want anyone to have a peek. Well, they gave me a little peek. I'm holding up a book. They sent me a little pamphlet, and it is the very first few pages of the book, so I will have a hint of what it's going to be about. But I'm so happy that Cassandra Clare is going to be joining me, and we're going to be talking about her Shadowhunters novel and the whole series, and she will be joining me sometime at the bottom of the hour. But meanwhile, I want to remind everyone, I had mentioned that Bria Burton is going to be the guest host back here on Joy on Paper. She loved it so much. She was raring to go. And so on Thursday, February 9th, Bria will be here. And it is so wonderful. She's going to interview two of the authors for whom she did book buzzes. And that's what's so much fun about these book buzzes that we're doing for everybody. We want to do as many as we can to help authors promote their books, both to play them here, and then I give them to the authors so they can put them on their websites and on their social media so that they can help promote their books and get their name out there. And Bria has two wonderful, wonderful sci-fi authors that will join her on Thursday, February 9th, Edward Ashton, and his book is called Mickey 7, and it's soon to be a major motion picture. And her other guest will be Carol Stivers. And we're going to play the book buzz that Bria did for Carol's book. As always, it is fabulous.
Hello, fellow sci-fi readers. This is author Bria Burton reporting for Joy on Paper with your science fiction book buzz. Today's communique to galaxies near and far includes a 2022 Goodreads Choice nominee, The Mother Code by Carol Stivers, with stellar narration by Sonila Nankani. The 2020 release is available in print, ebook, and audiobook. Now, let's download the book buzz. A virus decimates populations all over the world, and a team of U.S. military tech experts execute a plan to save humankind from extinction. Their solution involves genetically altered embryos immune to the virus and artificially intelligent mothers who can carry and deliver the babies. In the event of human extinction, these mothers must be programmed to raise the only hope for the future. A colonel's fateful misstep changes the course of humanity, and the dual timeline fast-forwards to a harsh desert region where a robot mother called Rosie raises a child who knows no mother but her. As the past and future collide, a new set of challenges emerge, a battle for human survival and the unexplored bond between a child and his AI mother. This thought-provoking and richly scientific debut novel grapples with questions of motherhood while exploring human survival in a post-pandemic world, creating a cathartic experience for readers. Author Carol Stivers received her PhD in biochemistry from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and went on to postdoctoral work at Stanford University before launching a career in medical diagnostics. Her combined love of writing and her fascination with the possibilities of science brought to life her first novel. This is Bria Burton with your futuristic fiction fix, signing off.
Okay, thank you, Bria, for that, and I am looking forward. I will be listening in on February 9th when you take over Joy on Paper, and I know you're going to have lots of fun, so we are just making sure that everybody knows about it. It will be on my website. It will be also on Facebook, and make sure that you mark your calendars for that. Now, as I said, the book buzzes that we do are for first of all, they're free. We do them for the authors so that we can help them promote their books. And when I first started the program, I was so honored that a very famous author joined me here on Joy on Paper, Robert K. Tannenbaum, to do some special book buzzes of books that he considers and that I consider essential books, books that you really should read. And he did one, just a beautiful one, that I want you to listen to, because history is so important. And many of you, of course, have seen the streaming video of John Adams. And that series is based on this book that Robert K. Tannenbaum is going to be talking about.
A Book Buzz Moment with Robert K. Tannenbaum, author of the best-selling Butch, Carp, Marlene, Champy series.
John Adams, David McCullough's book, published at Simon & Schuster. And the reason I chose John Adams is that the relevance of Adams is as it was in American history, with the great honest Yankee patriot who gave all for his country and had one of the great love affairs with his wife, Abigail Adams, who was way ahead of her time as a fabulous individual, is that John Adams and his, and who we call the founders, his colleagues, pledged their lives, their fortune, and their sacred honor, and compromised in order to make sure that we had a country. And this son of a farmer led a revolution that changed the world. The notion of compromise, the notion of having a vision, did not interfere with his ability and that of his colleagues that whom he influenced in order to create the vision of America. And one of the many things he did, which I think is most relevant, particularly as it impacted me and continues to impact me with my value system on all the 31 books that I've done, is the case that we know popularly as the so-called Boston Massacre that happened on March 5th, 1770. And very quickly, the facts of that case are there was a British sentry posted in front of the nearby custom house in Boston, and he was taunted by a group of a few hundred who came there of colonists, and then a backup team of British guards came, 8 soldiers and a captain, and during this melee, the Brits were pelted with ice, stones, snowballs, oyster shells, and then they opened fire, and 5 people and colonists in the mob were killed, and they were tried. And Sam Adams, the cousin of John Adams, saw this as a great opportunity to stir up public opinion and use it for propaganda in order to continue the movement into the revolution, and he called it a bloody butchery. And who was the person who defended the British soldiers and the captain? None other than John Adams. He felt that it was significant that the facts in a court decide the case, not public opinion or propaganda, but the facts of the case. There was no prejudgment from his point of view. It's the whole basis of due process that we live with today, embedded in the Fifth Amendment. Nobody should be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process, and in the 14th and equal application of law to everyone. And so it was Adams who argued the case and had the captain acquitted and 6 other of the, there were 2 trials actually, one for the captain and one for the other 8 soldiers, British soldiers, and 6 of the soldiers were also acquitted. He demonstrates a fierce integrity, but most importantly, what he demonstrated was something we live with today and something I live with in the DA's office. That is to say, Adams believed that it was better that many guilty persons escape unpunished than one innocent person should be convicted. The conviction of the unjustly accused in our system of government was anathema to him, as it is to those of us who cherish the Constitution, along, of course, read consistently with the Declaration of Independence. And that aspect derives from the notion that we are about freedom, not government interference with that freedom. And the exoneration of the unjustly accused was the very basis of the book I did, Echoes of My Soul, which is my 3rd nonfiction book, which I'll talk about a little bit as we go forward. But the notion that Adams believed this and suffered public scorn because he was, with respect to handling the so-called Boston Massacre case, he was out of step with popular outrage. That didn't interfere with his fierce integrity and his honesty and commitment to what was important. And he also, in the larger sense, understood that there had to be compromise because all the colonies, he wanted all 13 colonies to support the Constitution and be committed to the new country. And so he needed Virginia because Virginia was the most wealthy colony. And notwithstanding slavery, he compromised and dealt with Jefferson, dealt with Madison. He dealt with slave owners. He was a major abolitionist, and the compromise was that he desperately wanted to have Virginia lead the way so that the rest of the South would be part of the Union, and that Union he wanted to be unanimous. So the second president of the United States, the first to occupy the White House, spent a lot of time overseas during the course of the American Revolution, and one of the areas that he was most important in is after the battle of the victory at the Battle of Saratoga, of which Aaron Burr was a major player, then as a fighting general for Washington, was that once the Dutch realized that the British could be defeated in 1778 at the Battle of Saratoga, they decided that they would loan substantial funds because of Adams pleading for that behalf so that the American Revolution could continue. And so the notion of John Adams is to me one of the greatest Americans who ever lived, dedicated his entire life to formulating the vision of America, something we enjoy today that is precious. The most precious gift we have is to be an American. That means to be free, free from government intrusion and the far-reaching effects of the development of agencies that have a way of diminishing our freedoms as well. Interestingly, he and Jefferson died on their day, which was July 4th, 1826. And Adams, who was very frugal, left an estate of $100,000 approximately to his family. And Jefferson, who was an aristocrat, was in debt $100,000. But both men came back into friendship after the bitter election of 1800. And it is remarkable and inspirational when one understands the intellect, the self-sacrifice, and the genius of our founders, epitomized by, of course, John Adams and Alexander Hamilton, Washington, of course, and Jefferson and Madison. This book is worth reading.
It is worth reading. And really, every one of David McCullough's books are worth reading. One of the things that really makes me sad is I had hoped to speak to him about John Adams and about his other books back in 2020. And of course, with the pandemic and everything that happened and the years sort of blended into a big mess, I never did get to talk to him. And unfortunately, he passed away last August in 2022. So it really made me sad because I have read most of his books. They are all fantastic, right across the board. You think of something important in American history, and he wrote about it. David McCullough won 2 Pulitzer Prize awards. He was a National Book Award. He got National Book Award, and he also got the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which, of course, is the highest honor for a civilian. And he deserved it because he had... His books are so, you know, people will say, oh, well, it's difficult to read history. It's not difficult to read David McCullough. His books are so fresh and light. And when I talk about joy on paper, nobody, no historian ever had so much joy as he did. And he one time talked about how he was so lucky. He had an absolutely marvelous childhood. And I remember when I heard that, I thought, well, I was so happy for him because that's how I think of my childhood. I had a marvelous childhood. And again, most of it was just reading and running around wild and doing whatever I wanted and in a nice way. And so that's the same thing that David McCullough had. And you must read his books. And I want to recommend one particular one to all of you writers out there. You're always looking for story ideas. You're always looking for research. And there is one particular book, and everybody will just enjoy this book. It is called Americans in Paris. It was a number one bestseller. And it is really, it's so remarkable in so many ways. He takes all of the really famous Americans who went to Paris, some to study, like John Singer Sargent, some to study art, like Mary Cassatt. But Americans who went to Paris, discovered Paris, found so much that changed their lives, but then that actually changed our lives too, because they brought back ideas, they brought back art, they brought back books, they brought back so much. And I love his stories. They're very, they're so descriptive that you feel like you're in Paris walking with all of these famous people. He takes you to their homes. He takes you to their dinner parties. He takes you to their family events. He talks about what influenced them. And I love how he talks in one section where he's talking. He's writing, and so many of the people who did go to Paris, so many of the Americans, famous Americans who went to Paris, discovered that Paris was so much more than what they thought. And what we're thinking today, people will say, oh, you know, it's busy, it's got great museums, it's got, you know, wonderful things to do. But in the essence of it, and I hope it's the same way today, because it was for me, for the years that I went to Paris, where I went almost every other weekend to Paris for years, it was the people. And I never, in all the time I went to Paris, ever saw a rude Parisian. They were always so kind. They were always so generous. The people of Paris were hardworking, just ordinary people, wonderful people, and I had so much fun there. And so when I got this book, The Greater Journey, it was published back in 2012, so I had read it back then, but then I got the Audible. The Audible is fantastic, beautifully read. And the nice thing about it, of course, the narrator speaks French, and so pronounces all of the locations correctly. And for all of you people who are like hesitant, how do you pronounce this? How do you pronounce that? I think the Audible version of The Greater Journey is absolute perfection. You will love it. It's a wonderful book, and I hope you will get it. So again, it's called Americans in Paris by David McCullough, a brilliant author and a great loss to all of us who love history, because his writing is terrific. And it reads like a novel. It reads like a friend is talking to you. That's what I always think about his writing. So I'm going to play some commercials, and then I'm coming back, and I'm just going to wait here very anxiously for Cassandra Clare.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
With Z, and I am back, and I am just waiting for a call-in from Cassandra Clare, and it's going to be fun to talk to her about her newest book, Chain of Thorns, The Last Hours. It is embargoed. Now, you know, in the publishing world, this doesn't happen very often. I remember, of course, when the Harry Potter books were embargoed, and they could not release them until midnight. My boys were, my husband would take the boys and they would be in line, I think starting around 9:30, and they would just be waiting for the doors to open at, in those days it was Borders. I think we normally went to Borders. It was the store that was nearest us, but they would be in line and they would wait. And my husband was so great, and it didn't matter what the weather was. And the boys were so enthusiastic. They would wait there and they would wait in line. And I know my goddaughter also was waiting in line, Kenesha, because she's also, you know, that Harry Potter generation. And it was so exciting my husband thought it was absolutely wonderful that kids could be so excited about reading, and he would be so thrilled to see, you know, lines going around the block. And there the kids would wait, and they would be having fun in line, talking, chatting, getting to know each other, all very, very just, you know, when they have that joy on paper and they wanted that book, they were in a good mood. And the doors would open and they'd go in, and of course they'd have all sorts of Hogwarts stuff and treats and things for the kids and people in costume. And it would be midnight and the kids would just get these books, and they were big books, you know, they're not the little books, and what's 400, 500 pages, and some kids would just plop on the floor and start reading, and it was always so exciting. But those books were embargoed because they didn't want anybody to read them beforehand. And so in the publishing world, I think that's the highest you can go. It's also wonderful, you know, if your book gets auctioned. This is something that all authors hope for, that you know, their book will be auctioned, go up for auction. But this is the higher level, I think. So I'm excited to talk to her about that. Wow. I think some of you probably have seen the movie or the streaming video of her books, but they're not the same as her books. I mean, you know, this is the thing. They change it, you know. Even famous authors, and of course, when she sold the rights, I'm sure she wasn't so famous as she is now. Now she would have control, and that's something that authors learn. Of course, J.K. Rowling learned that very early, and she controls the rights to her Harry Potter. And so it's still, no matter what happens, she has a say in what happens to her character. And that's true, you know, when you're thinking about it, if you write a character and you suddenly realize, well, you know, this is a really, really good character, and I might be able to make something of it, that's the time before you get too famous. If you write your first book and you say, yeah, you know, I can see this going for 10 years or 20 years. I can see it as a movie. I can see it as a game. I can see it as, you know, a 3D something or the other, whatever we're going to have in the future. This is the time to protect your intellectual property rights correctly, to get everything possible set up before you actually get out there and start selling, you know, hundreds and thousands and millions of books. People always, you know, if you really, really believe in your character and really, really believe, then that's when you need an intellectual property lawyer like, you know, Bill Larson, who comes on Joy on Paper, and he talks about intellectual property. And this so often, and he, I mean, that's why he's in business. That's why he, you know, has a lot of important cases, because people don't always have everything that they need in a contract. And especially in intellectual property. First of all, you have to have an intellectual property lawyer who belongs to AIPLA, which is AIPLA, because those are the guys who know and gals who know what is going on. And not only what is going on now, what might go on. They have to be also, in a way, dreamers. They have to have imaginations. What in the world can happen in the future? What can the your intellectual property be worth in the future? And that should all be on paper before you get too big. Because once you get, you know, you get out there, you get really big, and if you don't have it all that organized, you can really, well, many, many authors have. They've lost their rights and they haven't made the money that they should have made because they didn't have it protected. So Bill Larson is a wonderful guy, and he will be happy to answer all your intellectual property questions, and you can contact him. Just go to his website. But again, this is something that you have to consider. Now, in Cassandra's case, woo! She's got valuable intellectual property here, because I'm sure, as I said, it's been movie, streaming video. I don't think they've taken that on yet into any of the theme parks, but who knows? She'll have her own theme park, maybe, at the rate she's going. So it's just fun. I think I just love it. One of the things that people say, well, how do I get big? How do I get that way? Well, of course, you have to write a really good book, and Cassandra is a really great writer. If you're looking for an agent, I hope that you will go to Publishers Weekly, because it starts really, when you get into the big time, it starts with having a good agent, somebody who gets you all into all the right places and with all the right people. And in this case, Simon & Schuster are Cassandra's American publishers, and I was so thrilled when I got home yesterday, because I knew it was going to happen. And this is how their timing. I had a big FedEx box, big box, and inside the box were her first two books in this series, collectible first editions, and then this lovely little pamphlet book. The beginning, the first little hint of what is going to happen in this wonderful series. And I think it's so exciting. And, you know, I was so thrilled. And so I'm so grateful to Simon & Schuster for sending it to me, because I didn't expect. The books are so big. They're so thick. I didn't count all the pages, but they're big books, gigantic books. And it is so, and they're beautiful. The covers, the artwork for the covers of Cassandra's books are all fantastic. She's working with an artist who is a true artist, and so it's always thrilling. And now I get to talk to Cassandra Clare. Hi, Cassandra.
Hi.
Oh, boy, oh, boy. This is so thrilling. You know, you are setting the bar so high, because, you know, most authors, when they come along and they're writing books, and they dream about being number one on Amazon. Maybe they dream about being a New York Times bestseller. And of course, you've achieved that. Then few imagine they're going to be global bestsellers like you. And now, I mean, now you're embargoed. Now that has to be the highest honor for an author ever.
I think it is, but I think it's quite funny, because when you are thinking about becoming an author, you don't know about how any of that works. So you don't know what it means to be embargoed or to have a strict on sale date or all of those things that, you know, if you're in the business, are suddenly a really big deal.
Yeah, you know, of course, any of the my listeners who are listening, and so many are, you know, people who write, my sort of catchphrase at the beginning of every show is, this program is Joy on Paper is for writers and those who dream of writing. So a lot of dreamers listen to this, and I've had quite a few, you know, authors, about a dozen authors who were auctioned, which was a big deal. But you're way, you're in the stratosphere.
You know, you never feel that way. You always feel like there's some new goal, some new thing you want to hit, some, you know, I don't know, imagined thing out there by which, you know, you have yet to achieve. I think we all have that to some extent.
Well, maybe we're all going to, the next one is, if you want to read Cassandra, you got to take that trip to the moon, because, I mean, what more? I know you've sold over 50 million books, but another one that really is a goal for authors, and I had not thought about it before, is the Oxford Union. To speak at Oxford Union,
yeah.
Isn't that, were you like, did it give you a thrill?
I totally did. I immediately ran to send that, when they sent me the email invitation, I immediately went to send it to my mother because I knew she would understand what a big deal it was, because my mom is a big Anglophile and she raised me to love England. We lived in London for a long time. She raised me to read like a lot of British writers, and so I was thrilled, and I knew that she would be thrilled. And in fact, she was so thrilled that she insisted that she come with me, and
well,
she did.
Definitely. I mean, that it is thrilling, because I lived in England when, and this is funny because a little bit of connection to with Jane Austen. When I was 11 years old, I decided that I was going to move to England and live near where Jane Austen was born.
Oh.
So when I was 21 years old, I had saved 20 through all my jobs and working, really sometimes three jobs. I saved $25,000 in those days. I went to England and I bought a 400-year-old cottage not far, 30 minutes from where Jane was born.
Oh, that is very impressive. That's dedication.
That's dedication. So I spent, many years in England, and just the idea of being in the audience at the Oxford Union.
Well, it was quite funny. I showed up and I had to check it. You have to check in, so you come in and there's the walls of the union are all covered in people who have spoken there before. So I'm looking at Obama and Madeleine Albright, and Laurence Olivier, and I'm like, oh my God, what am I doing here? And they come up and ask who I am, and I said, I'm Cassandra Clare, I'm checking in, and my mother says, and her mom. And I was like, I bet Madeleine Albright didn't bring her mom.
I think now to me that is the highest. I can't imagine any place better to speak at, unless they gave you Carnegie Hall, but you are fantastic. It's so funny too, you were born in Tehran, which is interesting because I lived in Tehran.
Oh, that is far more unusual. I think, yes, I was born in Tehran. My parents moved around a lot. That's why we spent time in London, Paris, Switzerland, cities, remote places. And my father was teaching in Tehran when I was born. I've always, I can baby talk a little bit in Farsi. So, when I tell people who are Iranian that I'm, I was born in Iran, they always get excited and they want to talk to me in Farsi. And I can only say things like, where's the kitty cat? And I would like some milk.
Do they say geshenge, geshenge? So that you were pretty? I bet they used to say that to you when you were a baby. They'd say geshenge, geshenge.
What they were really excited about, actually, was that I had red hair, and they would touch my hair, and they would say to my mother, she has the blood of Alexander, because their whole theory was that Alexander the Great, when he conquered Persia, brought blonde and red hair with him.
Exactly. Oh, wow. And I didn't even mention the name of the book. My goodness, I get so excited. Well, the two things, I think the embargo and Oxford Union just got me. But the name of the book, of course, it's from the Shadowhunters novel series. Oh, my goodness. Chain of Thorns, The Last Hours. And again, this wonderful thing, it takes place a lot in London and Paris and the cities that we love and that I know you lived in.
Yes, absolutely. I love, as it sounds like you do, the British classics, Sherlock Holmes, Jane Austen, Charles Dickens, I adored growing up. And so that sort of time period, that kind of setting has always called to me, and I didn't see any reason why I couldn't do it and combine it with fantasy, because, you know, I'm always excited about the idea of combining genres, and so this is a story of, you know, murder and magic and the supernatural that is set in Edwardian London just 2 years after the Queen Victoria died.
You know, if for my listeners, so many of them, of course, have seen the television and the movies, but I have to tell them the books are so much better. The books are so... They are so good. It's sort of like Sue Grafton was a guest here on the program.
Oh, and I love her book.
Yeah, we were friends. And so she never sold her rights because she just couldn't take it. She didn't want to see what they would do because we had both worked on scripts. And so we knew that the books don't translate quite the way the author hopes. Because really, yeah. Your books are so, so much better. They are really fantastic.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Yeah, somebody once gave me a T-shirt that said, "Don't judge a book by its movie."
I think so. What do you want to say about the book? We can't say too much. They sent me this little pamphlet with just... I love it. I treasure this.
I guess I would say that, I'm very excited now to be putting out the third book and to be finishing the trilogy. I know a lot of people like to wait for a series to be finished before they start reading, and so I would say now is a great time. You can get all three books and just read through them all, like binge-watching a TV show. And this has been one of my favorite series to write because I really do love the setting. I love the time period, and I really adore these characters. Very sad, for bittersweet for me to say goodbye to them at the end of the series. And I think, for anyone who likes, history, who likes mystery, who likes romance or adventure, any aspect of those things, there's something in the book for you. It's definitely a book with a big cast, a lot of different characters to relate to in different ways.
Oh, a lot of characters. And the thing is...
I know.
Yes, a lot of characters. But it's so much fun to read. So tell us just a little bit about Cordelia and a little bit about Matthew and the basic storyline that we can't give too much away, but just to intrigue my listeners.
Of course. Cordelia is a young woman who has spent a lot of time with her family traveling all over the world and never stay in one place for very long. So that's definitely drawn from my own experience. Her mother is Iranian. They would have said Persian in 1903, so she's half Persian. And I, took some of my own memories of sort of the food and the some cultural things about Iran to build her character. So the enormous scandal happens. Her father is accused of a terrible crime, and she feels she must travel to London and clear his name. She gets to London. She is drawn into this mystery. Someone has been killing shadow hunters, who are these magical race of people to which she belongs who fight demons, and someone's been killing them and leaving their bodies around London. They seem like Jack the Ripper killings, so they think, maybe it's the same kind of thing. But as they begin to investigate, they realize that this is not a human being killing other human beings. This is a supernatural force, and it's trying to accomplish something through these murders. And through all of this, Cordelia, she becomes a warrior. She finds her strength. She falls in love with a boy named James Herondale. Tragically, he is in love with someone else. Matthew, meanwhile, his best friend, falls in love with her. So we have some complications. We have some love triangles. We have some murder. We have some mystery. We've got some of everything.
Exactly. So explain where you came out with the idea of shadow hunters in the first place, where they come from, and because they are fighting demons. And it comes all the way back to your first idea about this whole subject.
Yeah, I've always been fascinated by folklore and mythology. And I remember the idea came to me when I was in a tattoo shop with a friend of mine who was a tattoo artist, and she was showing me her designs. And I thought, I've never gotten a tattoo. It's very funny that I've written a whole series of books about people with tattoos because I don't have one. But I was looking at her, I'm too cowardly, I was looking at her designs, and I thought, and she was telling me kind of the history of tattoos, how, almost all cultures have some, you know, method of inking the skin with marks, and there's always been a belief that these marks would be protective in battle, or they would stop you from bleeding, or they would be healing. And I thought, what if there was a race of people for whom this tattoo-based magic really worked? And that's sort of how Shadowhunters came to be. I thought, well, okay, you know, they're this band of warriors. They use these sort of magical tattoos to make themselves stronger, faster. You know, what are they fighting? Okay, they're fighting demons. And so that was the sort of the genesis of the idea of the Shadowhunters, and how they were this secret society that people didn't know about, but their job was to protect humanity.
And it goes all the way, it starts off in the 11th century, right?
That's correct. It's 1,000 years ago during the Crusades.
Now, explain this word. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it. I want to hear you pronounce it. How do you pronounce it?
Is it Parabatai?
Parabatai.
Yeah, no one can pronounce it. You're not alone. I was thinking of doing it like some kind of a pronunciation guide for the books. It's a Greek word, and I'm not even sure that I am pronouncing it correctly. This is what I was told by a friend who teaches Greek and Latin. So they said parabatai, so that's how I say it. In Greek, in Greek military history, these were two warriors who fought together. One was the sort of the charioteer, the other was the side man, you know, sort of shooting arrows from the chariot. So one drove, the other fought. And so in the book, the concept is that this is someone that you choose to be your parabatai, who is your warrior partner. It's a platonic bond. You fight together. You're bonded to each other. If one of you dies, the other one, you know, is going to nearly die. So it's based on that Greek history, but I sort of put a magical spin on it.
Well, of course, you have an interest in Greek mythology and all of this. You use allegory a great deal in your writing.
Mm-hmm.
Explain sort of your background, how your education. Where did this all come from? Just from your reading? Did you study it in school?
I think it comes from my reading. Like, because we did travel so much, my parents were constantly pulling me out of school. So, you know, I'd often be in school for half a year, and then they'd take me out, and so we could go somewhere. And I remember when my father needed to finish, I think it was his thesis for his job as a professor. I was like 9 or 10, so I didn't know what he was doing. And so he wanted somewhere quiet, so he took me and my mother to a remote area in Switzerland where there was literally nobody around for miles. And as you can imagine, as a, you know, 9-year-old child, this is not your ideal situation. So I just read, you know, I read all the time. And I think it's from that. I would read whatever was in a house. I would take down the book and read it. So it taught me to read very widely and read outside my, you know, comfort zone, or read books that I didn't know that I was necessarily going to like until I did read them. And I think that gave me a very sort of broad base of mythology, allegory, folklore to draw on, and a really interesting sort of group of things that fascinated me that I might not otherwise have encountered. And my mother would also teach me, you know, we did a bit of homeschooling so that I could, you know, pass into the next grade when we got home. But I really do think it was the reading.
Well, now your books have been translated, I think, into 34 or 35 languages. How many languages do you speak?
I speak French. I speak Italian badly and Spanish badly.
Well, so at least you can read a little bit of you.
Yeah. In French, I can read my books. And I think that's always interesting, you know, to see how that translator has handled, you know, whatever, you know, things you have done in your books, especially jokes, which are probably, I think, the hardest thing to translate. But in most other languages, I can't tell.
Well, before you came on, while I was waiting for you, because I didn't have any other guests today, I didn't want to have anybody else today but you. I was talking about your illustrations, and I was thinking about, you know, of course, you work with a true artist who creates amazing artwork for you. Now, what do you do with the covers of the? Do you have like a wall or a house covered now with all of these?
Well, the artist who does my covers, Cliff Nielsen, he is a wonderful artist, and what he does is he takes photographs and then he paints over the photographs. And so it's this kind of fascinating combination of, like, his own painting and digital photography. Then there are several artists I've also worked with, you know, on other covers. So it's true, I do have a set of the covers that's framed in one of the guest rooms of my house, and then there was also an artist named Kathleen Jennings who did a set of silhouettes, like paper cutout silhouettes, which were extremely popular, as I'm sure you know, in the Victorian and Edwardian era, and she did silhouettes of all the characters out of paper cutouts, and those became the illustrations in Chain of Iron, which was the second book. And I bought the originals from her because I just love them so much. They're so beautiful. And so those are framed also in my office.
Well, of course, I don't have to ask if you what you're writing next. I'm sure you're writing. I love on your website on the front, it says, contemporary milieu, sharp dialogue, Claire's female characters are smart and sassy, which is what probably describing you.
I mean, I'd like to think that I'm sassy. I'm working on it.
I think so, absolutely. And now I realize too, there is another goal for writers. You know, I didn't think about it, but J.K. Rowling's got it, and she got her theme park. So,
Oh my goodness! Can you imagine?
This is your next level, I think, because where else are you going to go? You're embargoed until January 31st. I can't read. They won't let me.
Well, I know. I'm like, I don't know. I'll have to talk to my agents about who has my theme park rights. They do exist. They're part of your contract. That someone owns your theme park ride. But I can't think of anyone besides J.K. Rowling and some famous authors now dead who have theme park rides.
Well, no, you know, I think they could make a theme park out of you. Some of them, they could make some heck of rides. Because
from your lips to God's ears, I would love to have a theme park.
Well,
you're right. I'll make that my next goal.
Well, you know, I'm here in Florida.
I'm gonna say I want to ride.
You know, I'm here in Florida. you know, I'm 45 minutes from Orlando, where we have, of course, the Harry Potter theme park. And I'm sure, you know, tonight I'm sure kids are lining up at bookstores. It's nice that there are bookstores still. And that they will be lined up like they were for the Harry Potter book. You know, your books are very big. How many pages is this new one?
They are long, but you know, so were the Harry Potter books. I feel like,
yeah,
you know, there's a kind of book where you want to just kind of be in the world, and my readers are always asking how long the books are, and they always want them to be longer than they are.
Oh, exactly.
And I'm like, we can't go any longer.
You can't lift them.
They are very good for as paperweights. But, what I generally say to people when we talk about length is really it's often a function of character. There are a lot of characters in the Chain of Thorns series. You know, there's the big group of friends, and they all kind of have their own story, and so those stories interweave, makes for a longer book. And I always loved a long book when I was a kid.
Me
so I think
too.
You often
I love long
what
books.
You enjoyed.
And it gives me hope. When kids can read long books, it's great. It means they get if a book gets them excited, they will read it. And, you know, all those problems with are kids going to be reading books in the future? Yeah, if they're really great, they read them.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's, you know, oh my goodness. I mean, I remember once I was signing, there was a long line. It was probably a 3-hour line. And the people at the back of the line, by the time they came to the front, had read the book that had just come out. And I was like, it took me a year to write that, and you just read it in 3 hours. But I was very happy because I thought, you know, these are kids. They clearly couldn't wait. They're clearly huge readers, and they just devoured it. And that's what you want.
Yeah, and they will. They'll devour. It's amazing. The kids will devour one of these big books, 500, 600 pages, in a few hours, like you said, 3 hours. They would do that when the Harry Potter, they would be in the bookstore. They'd sit down in the corner. They'd leave the book, you know, they'd open at midnight, and everything would be going. But there'd always be some kids who would sit in the corner, you know, just sit, plop down, and read until they, and of course, they reread it then. then they have the fun.
Of course, that's part of the fun.
They read it once, and they read it again, and they read it over. And like my goddaughter, Kanisha, she's still rereading Harry Potter books because, you know, it's fun. And that's what you've done here with your books. You have this, well, of course, you're a fantastic writer. I mean, your writing is good. I can recognize the sort of the influences that you've had in your writing because, as you said, you love Dickens, and he certainly knew how to tell a good story, and you are a great...
And he wrote a long book, too.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, I love him, and I last year I reread Nicholas Nickleby, you know, all the pages. I wanted to, you know, do the whole book again because I remembered it from when I was young, and in between I had read a few parts of it. But this time I did it with the audio. I read the book and the audio. It was fantastic. So I know that the kids are going to have, young people, because it's not kids, it's young adults, and it's adults, a lot of adults are reading it. I know now my goddaughter's, you know, like 30 years old, but she's going to be reading it because that's what they do.
Absolutely. You know, some books you grow up with, and some books, and many books are timeless, you know. Especially coming of age novels, because that's something that either, you know, you can read while you're going through it, or you can read when you're older and you remember it. You know, you remember that time period in your life.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. As I said, you're my first embargoed author on Joy on Paper.
Embargoed author.
It's coming up to the 8th anniversary of Joy on Paper, and I've talked to over 1,500 authors in this time. And I'm so glad that I have the first embargoed one.
Oh, well, that's very sweet. And, you know, my first embargoed book, I called my parents to say I've been embargoed, and they thought it was a bad thing. They thought I meant that my book had been banned. I was like, no, embargoed is good.
Oh, well, again, Cassandra Clare, you're fantastic. People, you can find her books wherever books are sold, and you can stand in line at midnight on, it's going to be released January 31st, but pre-order it. I'm sure your pre-orders are now already in the million, at least a million, so you know.
Well, I hope so. They don't tell me.
I know they
later,
don't tell you.
So I'll find out at some point. But yes, go ahead and pre-order it. There's a special collector's edition that's just the first print run of the book. So once those are gone, they're gone forever. So, you know, pre-order that to get the version with the illustrations and all the cool stuff. And thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it's been a joy to talk to you. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay,
bye.
All right. Woo, woo. What a book. What a book. All right, everybody. That was a nice interview. I enjoyed talking to her. Oxford Union. Oh, to talk to the Oxford Union. That is, that should be. That's my goal. But I don't think I'm ever going to write a book that'll invite me there. Anyway, everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful day. I have to say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. He helped me get all the book buzzes organized. Remember to mark your calendar, February 9th. Bria Burton is going to be the guest host, and what can I say? It's very exciting to talk to an embargoed author. Wow, a million! I'm sure she has a million pre-sales. Mary Higgins Clark, every time she released a book, she would have at least 1 million pre-sales. 1 million, so that at midnight on the day her book was released, she already had a million sales. Anyway, say something nice to somebody again. Bye-bye, everybody. Have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. And I think he saluted me. I wasn't looking. Yes, he saluted me again. So Big Ed saluted me. I'm a general around here. Bye-bye now.